This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Yofer Sichoson Shel Avdei Bosei Avos, Mr. Roson Shel Bonim. The ordinary conversation of the servants of the daughters of the Avos, of the forefathers, is more beautiful than the Torah of the sons. Parshosoi Shel Eliezer Shnayim VeGimel Dapim Roimro VeShoino. The whole parsha about Eliezer going to look for Rivka, the Torah takes two or three pages to say it, and repeats it the second time. It doesn't say when Eliezer comes and tells Lavan and Basura what happened, it doesn't say, and he said to them all that occurred. It actually goes through word for word, the whole story, all over again. And yet, the sheretz, megufe Torah, the laws of the sheretz, those particular creepy, crawly things which cause tumor and so on, is part of one of the main laws of the Torah. The ein dami metame kibsura. And how do we know that the blood of the sheretz also causes tumor? It's just from a word that's learnt, an extra word in the Torah, and from that we deduce it, we work it, but the Torah doesn't spare a word to teach us that halacha. And yet the Torah is quite liberal with its use of language in today's Sedra, and is quite happy to spend pages and pages going over the story of Eliezer. Then it goes on. And they gave him water to wash his feet and the feet of the people who were with him. The same thing. The washing of the feet of the servants of the daughters of the Ovis is more beautiful than the Torah of the sons. For even the fact that she gave water to wash their hands, what's that so relevant? Why do we need to know that? And so many words need to be spent in a Torah which doesn't even give us the halachas clearly, but it leaves it for us to work them out, doesn't use an unnecessary letter or an unnecessary word. And yet when it comes to the story of Eliezer, we see this amazingly liberal use of language and of vocabulary. So we see the Medrash dividing the Torah into two parts: the Sichoson Shel Avos, the ordinary events of the Avos, or the servants of the Avos, or the servants of the daughters of the Avos, and the Torah itself, the Torah Shel Bonim. By the Torah Shel Bonim, the Medrash means the actual, the Gufei Halochis, that section of the Torah which is constituted of Tzivuyim, of mitzvahs, of instructions given to us by the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's the one section of the Torah. And the other section of the Torah is the narrative. And the whole first part of the Torah, the whole of Sefer Bereishis and a large part of Sefer Shemot, is involved with narrative. The second part of the Torah is involved largely with listings of Tzivuyim, of Halochis. And the Medrash warns us not to take the narrative lightly, but that we see the Torah gives more attention to the relating of the narrative than it gives to the statement of the Tzivuy. That's the comment of the Medrash. And it's these two aspects of the Torah which we're going to deal with, based on an idea that I've been developing in the ladies' shiur on Shabbos mornings, which it's important for this shiur to know also. The Sefer of Iyov, as you know, is a philosophic analysis related as a debate between Iyov and his three friends to try and determine the purpose of suffering. And why is it that righteous people suffer and wicked people have it good, and so on. And Iyov states his problem and debates it with his three friends. And at the end of it, his friends have got nothing to say. After many chapters of questions and answers, he posing the questions, they suggesting answers, he tackling them on their answers, eventually they become subdued, they've got nothing more to say. And at that point, Eve begins to explain things as he sees them. And in a wonderful chapter, which is chapter 28 of Eve divides the world into two areas. The The first area he refers to is that area which is the area that can be defined, the area that is measurable. And no matter how precious an item is in that area, it still has a measurable value. Whether it's gold or silver, whether it's copper or steel, whatever it is, no matter what it is, how important it is, how useful it is, how valuable it is, there is nothing in that part of the world, in the material world, in the world which can be measured, there is nothing that cannot have a value given to it. It is marketable. But on the other side of the scale, he deals with the spiritual world, which he calls HaChokhmah, the wisdom. And when it comes to wisdom, he says, V'HaChokhmah me'ayin timotze, v'eizeh mekoyim bino. The wisdom, where can that be found, and what is the place of understanding? There is no market for wisdom, says Eev. You can't go to purchase it anywhere, you can't trade it anywhere, you can't mine it anywhere, you can't manufacture it anywhere. It is not something which is measurable, it is not something which can be constructed, it is not something which can be purchased and traded. Chokhmah is something different. And this leads him into his understanding of the world of the immeasurable. And it's through his division of the world into these two areas that he's able to cope with the question of the suffering of the tzaddikim. For the tzaddikim, he believes, are enjoying the benefits of the immeasurable world. Their suffering is in the measurable world. And there's no comparison. You cannot say that a person who's experiencing joy and elation in the measurable world and is suffering in the immeasurable world, you can't put the one against the other. These are two completely different things. They have nothing to do with one another. One has to see the world in these two ways. But this pasuk of V'hachochmah me'ayin timotze, which literally means, and wisdom, where from can it be found? Where is its place? Where does one find it? That pasuk, the Ikrim learns a little differently. The Ikrim says, in the second parak on the third section, he starts analyzing a pasuk in Kohelis, which we say in the davening every morning. U'moysol ha'odem min ha'behemo ayin ki ha'kul hova. Which normally is translated means, and the difference between man from the animals is nothing, for everything is nothing. And that's part of the whole theme of Kohelis. Hevel avolim hakol hevel. Nothing of nothingness. Everything is nothing. And of course that leads to a great deal of misunderstanding about what the book of Kohelis is all about. This negativism, people call it. This annihilation of everything of value. Everything is nothing. Hevel avolim hakol hevel. And Eev goes through it, item by item, and he slowly demolishes the whole world as being nothing. On this pasuk of the difference between man and animal is nothing, says the Ikrim. Kaloma, that means to say, Hamisar hazeh al habehemo hu dovo shemetziyusu cholush. That does not mean that there is no difference between man and animal. Who could say such a thing? That means that the difference between man and animal is ayin. Ayin does not mean nothing, says the Ikrim. That's the important thing. Ayin does the thing in the Ikrim. The ayin does not mean nothing. Ayin means something ethereal, something so fine that it hardly exists. V'ilu omar ein reisol odom ala behemo, hoyom mashmoi mishpat sholo ilgomo. Had it said, had Kohelis said, there is no difference between man and animal, then that would have meant, literally as it says, there is no difference between man and animal. But that's not what Kohelis says. What does he say? He says, "Hamoysor umoysor odom min habehemo." Ein mashmo mishpat chiyuvi ki ilu omar sheish lo moysor avol achos sheomar umoysor odom min habehemo. But now that it says, and the difference between man and animal is, ein mashmo mishpat chiyuvi ki ilu omar sheish lo moysor ala behemo, v'ayitor nahu ayin. That means that there is an implication that there is a difference between man and animal, but that difference is very minute. Again, Kohelis says, the difference between man and animal is ayin. which normally translated means the difference between man and animal is naught. Says Koheles, says the Ikrim, that's not so. Then it should have said there is no difference between man and animal. If you say the difference between man and animal is naught, that means that there is a difference, and that difference should be equated to naught. In mathematics, who's a mathematician? Do we have anybody? Isn't there a concept in mathematics that naught is not nothing? That naught is the opposite of infinity. It approaches zero, but it's not nothing. Isn't there such as anybody who's a mathematics fundi here? Dan, is there anything like that? Never heard such a thing. I seem to remember that there's such a thing that zero, there's no such thing as absolutely nothing. Naught means approaching nothing. And that's what ayin means. Ayin means something which is so fine it's as if it's not there. But it doesn't mean nothing. That's the principle of the Ikrim. And then he takes that on further to the Pasuk in Iyuv. V'al ha-koach hazeh, and it's talking about this very fine power, this energy. Omar Iyuv va'chokhmah me'ayin timotzeh. That's what Iyuv means when he says, and chokhmah me'ayin timotzeh is found in naught, in ayin. That does not mean in nothing, that means in something which is almost nothing. Kloma, that means ki metzius ha-chokhmo hu min ha-bechinius ha-nimtso be-odom ha-nikro-oyin. Wisdom is found in that aspect of man which is called nothing, which is called I. What is that aspect? Here we've got Eev stating the area of the immeasurable. That there are parts of man which are measurable and there are parts of man which are not measurable. If you want to measure man's stature, his height, his breadth, you can do so. His weight, you can do so. If you want to measure his eyesight, you can do so. If you want to measure his the effectiveness of his heart, you can do so. If you want to measure his hearing, you can do so. If you want to measure his intelligence, can you do so? Yes, they've made IQ tests. But by definition, if you can measure it, that's not intelligence that you're measuring. And that's the fallacy of the IQ test. You cannot measure chokhmah. If you can measure it, what you're measuring is not chokhmah. You're measuring a skill, but you're not measuring true understanding. You're not measuring intuitive understanding, deep understanding, wisdom. That cannot be measured. If you can measure it, if you found a scale for it, you must know that what you're measuring is not the thing. Because chokhmah ma'ayin timotzeh. Chokhmah belongs to that part of the human being which is ayin. Ayin means it has no physical form, it has no mass, it has no measurability. By physical form we don't mean only something with mass and only something which is material. By physical form we mean anything which can be measured. It has no measurability, and if it can be measured it's not chokhmah. By chokhmah me'ayin timotzeh explains the Ikrim, that means that wisdom belongs to that part of the human being which cannot be measured. That's what it is. And so we find that not only in the world but in man itself there are parts of the human being which can be measured, parts of the human being which cannot be measured. And anything which can be measured is not part of the field of chokhmah. That's part of the problem in which we find ourselves today, because our Western civilization involves itself almost entirely, perhaps entirely, with those things which can be measured. Things which cannot be measured do not belong to the realm of science and knowledge and all sorts of other areas. Now this concept of ayin, of something being created, which is ayin, which has no measurable form, it cannot be measured. And that wisdom, chokhmah, forms part of that. Is interesting in the area of the Bria itself, of the creation itself. When we talk about the creation as being made, yesh me'ayin, Hashem created the world, yesh me'ayin. He created something from nothing, that's the way we normally translate it. But the creation was a creation ex nihilo, that the Ribbono Shel Olam made something out of nothing. But now with our new definition, with the Ikrim's definition of the word ayin, it doesn't mean that he created something out of nothing. It means he created matter, something measurable, out of something non-measurable. Einstein almost discovered it. He almost got there. When he said that matter was created from energy, and that you can have something which is non-physical at least. Energy is not physical. And it can create matter. That was already a big chiddush. But we're going further than that. Science has not yet got to the point that we need to get, because energy is still measurable. There is something still more fine than energy. But just as that was a chiddush before the time of Einstein, nobody would have dreamed that matter could have been created from energy, that something material and physical could be created from something non-material. Nobody thought that was possible. So now people don't think it's possible that energy could be created from something still less measurable. But it is so. But at the end of the day, when we talk about Yesh Me'ayim, the Ribbono Shel Olam created existence from something, not which doesn't exist. He didn't create something out of nothing, that it has no meaning and no purpose, no value, whatever. He created something real, something touchable, something measurable, out of something immeasurable. And what was that? What does the Pesuk say? Hashem b'chochmo yosod oretz. The Ribbono Shel Olam built the world on wisdom, on chochmo. So what we really have is, we've got to take Einstein's equation one step further. Mass equals energy with some mathematical relationship, and energy equals with some relationship chokhmah. That it is the translation of the wisdom of the Ribbono Shel Olam, or chokhmah. We're using the word wisdom. Wisdom is too narrow a word. We see the way Eov is using the word chokhmah as all that which is not measurable. The power of the Ribbono Shel Olam can be transferred into energy, and energy can be transferred into matter, and that's what was created. That's the Yesh Me'ayim. And it says the Ribbono Shel Olam created the land, the world, the Oretz Tohu Vavoyu, and the world was nothing. What does that mean, it was nothing? Not that it was nothing, but it was nothing measurable, it was nothing real, it was nothing tangible. And from that nothingness, the Ribbono Shel Olam created, out of his chokhmah, out of his wisdom, he created the world. So the world is not just created from nothing using wisdom, the world is created out of wisdom, in fact. The Ribbono Shel Olam created the world out of wisdom. Now this measurable and the unmeasurable and the immeasurable is very important in the understanding of what happens in the world today. Because in our efforts to understand things, we have really only one method of understanding in the world today, and that is a quantitative method. We can really only value quantitatively. We can only value things if we can give them some kind of measure, if we can give them some kind of definition. And so we drag everything into the field of the measurability, of the measurable. But in so doing, we lose sight of a whole vast part of the Bria, which is not measurable. What we're saying is, not only is it not right to drag everything into the measurable, but even the measurable needs to be taken into the field of the immeasurable. One has to see, even in measurable things, one has to see the touch of the immeasurable. One has to see the touch of the eternal, even in those things which are not eternal. Even in physical things, one has to see the spiritual. Even in physical things, one has to see the eternal. One has to see something of the chokhmah of the Ribbono Shel Olam, of the inherent wisdom of the Ribbono Shel Olam. When we look at the world around us, we have to see not just the physical object, but we have to see much deeper than that. We have to see the value which lies beneath that. We have to see the principle. We have to see the wisdom from which that thing was created. And that applies not only in the fields of physics and our material world around us, but that applies in the Torah as well. That applies in the religious world around us as well. There's the famous Gemara in the Dorim of Pei Aleph, where the Gemara says in the Pesuk, "Mi ho ish hechochom v'yovin zois?" Who is a man wise enough to understand this? Dover zeh nishal lachachomim v'anvim v'lei pirshu. This matter was asked of the wise people and the prophets, and they couldn't explain it. Until the Ribbono Shel Olam himself explained it. The Chtiv, it says, "Vayomer Hashem." Hashem said, "Al ozvom es toirosi." The reason that there was a destruction of the Beis Hamikdash was because they departed from my Torah. They abandoned my Torah. Which means, says the Gemara, Shaloi birchu b'Torah tchilo, that they didn't make a brocha over the Torah first. They used to learn Torah, but they didn't make the brocha over the Torah first. Chosav Aram, Zal. And the Ram writes over there as follows. Midichtiv v'yemer Hashem al ozvom es toirosi. Since it says, and Hashem said, because they departed from my Torah, michlal, that implies, deleko deyodu la'aduri taimel, okut shabrichu bilchud. That means that the only one who knew the answer was the Ribbono Shel Olam. There was no Chacham, there was no Navi, there was no living person who could explain what was wrong with their learning. There appeared to be nothing wrong at all, and yet they lost the Beis HaMikdash. So there was something seriously wrong. And they asked all the Chachamim, and they asked all the Nevi'im, they couldn't find an answer, says the Rebbein Shlalom, because they didn't say the Bracha Matzor. The Ran goes on to explain, says, why is it in fact that other people didn't know? If they weren't making the Bracha, that's quite an easy thing to know. You see, the people aren't making the Bracha. It's not a difficult thing to find out. He explains, the Ran using Rabbeinu Yonah, it wasn't just that they didn't make the Bracha the formal thing, but they didn't treat the Torah importantly enough to make the Bracha. That means lo holchu bo, they didn't follow the Torah properly. Kolomer, that means bekavonoso v'lishmo, in the deep intentions of the Torah and the purity of intent, that was lacking. That means that you can have an entire society all occupied in the study of Torah, and it's wrong. It's just not good enough. And you can ask the educationists, and they won't be able to tell you what's wrong with it. And you can ask the Chachamim, and they won't be able to tell you what's wrong with it. And you can ask the Nevi'im, and they won't be able to tell you what's wrong with it. Only the Ribbono Shel Olam would know what's wrong with it. But it's serious enough to bring about the destruction of the entire society. What does that mean? That you can have a society externally working perfectly, so much so that nobody can perceive anything wrong with it. We're not talking about like today where one can see things that are wrong. We're talking in a society where nobody can see anything wrong. It looks perfect from the outside. And yet there's a decay inside which is enough to cause the destruction of the entire society. And only the Ribbono Shel Olam knows that decay. From here we see the value of the measurable and the immeasurable in Torah itself. The measurable can be perfect. The immeasurable cannot be measured by a human being. Only the Ribbono Shel Olam can measure the immeasurable. And so when they asked all the Chachomim and they asked all the Nevi'im, nobody could give them an answer, because from a measurable point of view, there was nothing wrong. It was only in the immeasurable dimension that things were decaying. And the Ribbono Shel Olam says, Allah Azwam is Torah. They've abandoned my Torah. And asked them, what do you mean they've abandoned my Torah? They were all learning. And if it was just that they didn't say the Bracha, surely that you could see that's measurable. Explains the Ran, it's not that they didn't say the Bracha. That's a measurable way of communicating the depths of the immeasurable wrong in their study. That there was a lack of purity. There was a lack of perfection. That immeasurable dimension of understanding the deep intentions of the Torah were not there. Of course, this is all very modern and very contemporary and very frightening, because that means that one can be involved in the external. I don't even want to use the term external, because it's much more than the external. When a person's involved only in the external, you can see it. We're looking at something more than that. A person can be involved in all the measurable parts of the Torah and still not be involved in the essence of the Torah at all. So much so that nobody will perceive it. A person can be going to shiurim and he can be learning and studying, but at the end of the day what he's learning is measurable things. Techniques, skill, quantity, and that's it. But the subtle understandings of what the Gemara is really trying to get at, what the basis is, what the living principles are, what the value system is by which one can operate, that one's not extracting from the pages of the Gemara. If one isn't extracting that from the pages of the Gemara, one is treating the Gemara or whatever other text one is using, one is treating it as a measurable form of knowledge. And our entire society is that way. And I've said so very many times that the religious world and the non-religious world, the Torah world and the secular world, always suffer from the same diseases. It just expresses itself in different ways. We're affected by one another. When the Torah world raises itself, the whole world rises with it. When the Torah world drops, the whole world drops with it, and we're affected by the same diseases. And the disease that the secular world is affected by is measurability, quantification. That anything which cannot be quantified is not given a value and is not related to. And in the religious world we're finding exactly the same thing taking place. That there is an indulgence in quantification, as important as that is, but when the quantification is without that unquantifiable element, then it loses its meaning completely, and it becomes completely unworkable. That's the, in a business sense, that's the age-old conflict that arises between the businessman, the entrepreneur, and the accountant, or the entrepreneur and the bank manager. The bank manager and the accountant is trained that all that matters are the figures. The entrepreneur doesn't know anything about figures and quantifying. He works with instinct. He works with a creative drive. He sees potential. He looks at the situation and he weighs up a sense of potential. There are no figures yet. There's nothing there. But he sees potential. He sees the potential for productivity. And that's where you've got a gap which is almost unbridgeable. The quantifying person cannot relate to things that cannot be quantified. And the person who's working in the unquantifiable field cannot sell what he has if it cannot be quantified. You've got to make, in order to sell something, you've got to make people relate to what it really is, and if there's nothing, it's difficult to relate to it. So you have this gap in all areas. The need to understand that quantification is only a framework, but that all belongs to the material side of the world. There's another part of the world altogether, and that's that which cannot be quantified. Human beings' life, it's the same thing. There are parts of people which are quantifiable, there are parts of people which are not quantifiable. And that's where the essence of the person lies. That's where the person really is. That's where his true personality lies. Rav Nachman Zvi Finkel brings another example of this confusion. Yaakov Avinu showed strength, physical strength, great physical strength twice. The one case was where he fought with the angel of Esav, and he beat him. For a man to fight with an angel, the Tzaro Shel Esav, and to come out victorious, great physical strength. The other time was when he went to the shepherds when he was running away from Lavan, and all the shepherds were gathering there, and he wanted to help the ones that were being molested, and he pushed off the on his own the stone that covered the well. Chazal say it was like removing a cork from a bottle. He did it with the greatest of ease. But it was a stone that all the shepherds had to come together to move off. No one person or no small group of people could do. One can imagine Yaakov Avinu was a yeshiva bocher. He wasn't exactly a Mr. Universe. The shepherds, you can imagine what they looked like. Outdoor types who ate briars every day, and drank beer and played rugby. You can imagine the types that they were. They couldn't open the, or as the economist in describing certain of our countrymen of this part of the world talks about the type of person whose neck is very thick, and as his head goes up it gets thinner and thinner as it goes up so those are the kinds that these shepherds were. They couldn't move the stone. Here comes the yeshiva bocher, Yaakov comes along, and like a feather, with the greatest of ease, he moves it. Which was a more spiritual event? We would say that beating the angel of Esav was a more spiritual event. But Rav Nachman Zvi, in his own inimitable way, quotes from a piyut that we say in the Tfilah of Geshem, in the prayer for rain that we said on Shmini Atzeres, the following phrase: Yached lev v'gal even me'al pi be'er mayim. He dedicated his heart, and with that strength was able to roll over the stone from the mouth of the well. Kenevat loy sar bol me'eshu mimayim. Just as when he fought with the angel, who is a combination of fire and water. Asks Rav Nachman Zvi, it should be the other way around. Which shows more physical strength? The picking up of the stone. So it should say he fought with an angel with the same kind of strength he demonstrated when he picked up the stone. But it doesn't say that. It says when he picked up the stone, he used the same kind of strength that he used against the angel. That means spiritual strength, not physical strength. Says Rav Nachman Zvi, you see that even physical strength, the essence of it is not the physical power. Well, the shepherd type, the type who drink the beer and play the rugby and have the briars, they rely on physical strength. They've got nothing else. But it is possible through spiritual strength to put them in the shade. It is possible to make nothing of them physically through the power of spiritual strength. That's that koyach that we call ayin. So you'll take, a scientist will take the yeshiva bocher, and he'll do a medical on him, and he'll see that he's not terribly fit, and his muscles are not terribly strong, and he's tired, and he's weak, and he's not all that well nourished. And they'll take the rugby player, and you'll see how fit he is, and how strong he is, and how mighty he is. And then you'll tell the doctor that the rugby player couldn't move the stone from off the well. The yeshiva bocher could. How do you explain that? Can't. There's ayin. There is a power which is not measurable, which the human being has. There are resources on which we can draw if we have the spiritual power, which are not physically measurable, which are not scientifically quantifiable. But those powers can be translated into an enormous energy, just as Yesh Me'ayin, as this physical world, was created out of spiritual powers which are not measurable. But Ribbono Shel'olam, through with his spiritual powers, non-measurable, non-quantifiable, created the quantifiable. So we can take our spiritual powers and we can have quantifiable strength with it, if we know how to do it. The Mata Tzvi goes on to explain how much we're impressed with the physical things. It says you'll take two people davening, and one person will have a long coat and a long beard, and he'll be shaking and shockling and davening out aloud. And you'll see another person standing next to him with a short jacket, no beard, and he'll be standing absolutely still, davening very softly. But nobody would think twice that the one shaking a lot and shouting a lot is the one who's davening with more kavana. We're impressed by physical things. But that's not where it all is, says Rav Notitz. How do you know? You're looking at the quantifiable. You're trying to take Yira Shemayim and you're trying to quantify it in a measurable way, and through that to decide who's who. You can't do that. That which is quantifiable is not Yira Shemayim. If you're measuring it, you're on the wrong thing. You're talking about the wrong thing. It's not measurable. And we need to understand and accept that we're dealing with a lot of life is in the unmeasurable and the unquantifiable, and we have to relate to it in that way, and we have to understand it that way, and we have to accept it that way. Finally, Eve says in this chapter 28, that only the Ribbono Shel Olam can measure wisdom. Elohim hevin darkov, hu yodas makoimo. Only Hashem knows the true place of Yerushalayim, of wisdom. Vayomer la'adam, and he said to man, hein yiras Hashem hi chokhmo, v'su meira bino. If you want to know what wisdom is, and you want to know what understanding is, wisdom is Yerushalayim, and bino, understanding, is the deviation from wrong, not doing wrong. That's what Bino is, and that's what Chochmah is. On the straightforward level, on the level which I started discussing it this morning at the Ladies' Shir, we have a very important statement in this pasuk. And that is, there are three areas of human activity. Three value areas. Material values, spiritual values, and moral values. And Eve is telling us here that the Ribbono Shel Olam says that if we're going to divide those three values into two categories, material values are on the one side, and spiritual and moral on the other. Wisdom and morality are inextricably linked. Yiras Hashem hi chokhmah. Wisdom is the fear of the Ribbono Shel Olam. The sumira bina, and understanding means, what is IQ? IQ is sumira. That's how you measure understanding. The ability of the person not to do harm, that's how you see a sophisticated intelligence. Not by an IQ test. The ethical level of a person is a measure of his wisdom. And his wisdom and his ethics have to be seen as one. The material world, the measurable world, the quantifiable world, that's something else. In the world in which we live, it's seen the other way around. We take wisdom and materialism, and we link them together, and we put ethics into the other world. For example, when it comes to wisdom, we pay for wisdom. Today in the United States, you can't go to a shir very easily without paying for it. Everything, there's a price for everything. You want a shir, you pay. And that's how people make their livings. And it becomes a business. And secularly, it's certainly so. You want a degree, you want to study, you've got to pay for it. We use knowledge to develop. And why do you study? What is the purpose of knowledge? To earn a living, to be able to material, to do business, to be able to progress materially. We use knowledge for the purpose of materialism, and we use materialism for the purpose of knowledge. We buy education with money, and we use our education to make more money. That's what it is at the end of the day. The whole education becomes a business as well. Wisdom becomes a business as well. Ethics, morality, that belongs to religion. That belongs to the church. That's a different field. Nothing to do with it. And so we've made the dividing line in the Western world, dividing matter and wisdom on the one side. Everything, we've made wisdom also quantifiable, and all that on the one side, and on the other side we have ethics and morality. Eve tells us that's not so. The way we're meant to see it is with wisdom, with materialism on the one side, anything quantifiable is material. And then we draw our line. And on the other side is everything which is non-quantifiable, which means wisdom and ethics. That's all part of the same unit, that's all part of the same module. That has to be seen as inextricably linked together.
But why in talking about ethics does Eve talk in the negative? Why does he talk about Yiras Hashem and not Ahavas Hashem? Why does he talk about the fear of God rather than the love of God? And why does he talk about Sumera rather than Asay Tov? Why does he talk about not doing evil rather than doing good? Because even in ethics there is the material and there is the spiritual. Even in morality there is that which is spiritual and there is that which is material. Materialism in ethics and in morality is that dimension or that aspect of morality which brings an income, which has benefits. And then there is that part of morality which has no benefit. The Alter von Kelm explains on this pasuk that when a person is doing good, there are other cheshbonos, there are all sorts of other calculations. Or the chances are that there are all sorts of other calculations. He'll get a certain amount of kovod, he'll get a certain amount of recognition, of honor and glory for it, he'll get a thank you for it. He might even be able to make some money out of it. There are all sorts of side benefits that come from doing good. But there are no side benefits that come from not doing evil. Not at all. If somebody comes to you and says, what do you think of so-and-so? I want to give him a job. And you give him a wonderful recommendation. There can be side benefits. Because he will go to the person and he'll say, you know, you've got a wonderful recommendation from so-and-so. And one day, who knows, you might need that fellow too, and he'll pay you back, he'll feel an indebtedness to you. But if you know something about him, which could ruin his interview, but it's not something that's really relevant, it's not something which the prospective employer needs to know, and you decide not to say a word about it, not a word, that will never get out. Who will ever know that you didn't say anything about it, that you could have said and that you didn't say? That's the purest form of ethics that there is. The Sumera is a spiritual ethics. That's the only totally non-quantifiable form of ethics. Any other morality and ethics, all the positive sides of morality and ethics, there can be benefit for. That's a different thing altogether. You let somebody else through the door first, you open the door for somebody, you give your chair to somebody, all those things there's a thank you for. All those things have a quantifiable feedback. But just not hurting anybody, not harming somebody else, that there's no quantifiable feedback for at all. That's pure ethics and that's pure morality. And so Eev says, if you really want to know what Chochmah is and you really want to know what Bino is, if you know what purity in the area of the quantifiable, of the non-quantifiable is, that value which is absolutely non-quantifiable is when wisdom expresses itself in the passive form. When wisdom expresses itself in what you don't do, then you know you're dealing with that which is absolutely pure. Now we get back to our Medrash. The Medrash says there are two parts of the Torah. There are the Gufei Halochas. There are those Halochas which are quantifiable. Those Halochas which can be calculated. Those Halochas which can be worked out. Those Halochas which have mathematical structure, which have definition, which have logic and so on, which are so to say measurable. But then there's a whole area of Halocha which is not measurable. The area of interpersonal relationships, not measurable really. The area of just how to behave, how to talk, what one does and what one doesn't do, not really measurable. And we find it very uncomfortable to operate in an unmeasurable area, in an unquantifiable area, because we feel insecure. We've been taught to quantify everything. We lack a natural intuition. We haven't been taught the intuitive sense of what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what's bad, what one does and what one doesn't do.
It's sometimes amazing to people who come from Torah families, from true Torah families, people who've seen how Torah is meant to be lived and practiced, and they sometimes see people, Balei Tshuva, sometimes of many years standing, and they say to me, but how can they do such a thing? Don't they know that one doesn't do such a thing? And I have to answer them, from where should they know that one doesn't do such a thing? Where does it say that you don't do such a thing? It doesn't say anywhere, but everybody knows that. Everybody knows that if you've been taught that. But if you haven't been taught to operate in that unquantifiable area, you don't know that. Little things, subtle things. How to speak, how not to speak. How to treat people, what is courteous, what isn't courteous. Formalities. The way of operating within a structure, within a Torah structure. Outside of a Torah structure, it's little things. Common courtesies, at least we pick up to a degree from the world around us. Because even the Goyim have certain common courtesies. But there are Torah courtesies as well. You can have people, even in my own shul, you can have people who daven in my shul and don't come and take a Shabbos afterwards. That is absurd. That's unheard of. That is like going to lunch in somebody's home and not coming after, not introducing yourself. It's like walking in and sitting down to a meal and going out, and the Barabbas doesn't know who you are, and you did nothing. You didn't say hello to him. You didn't say goodbye to him. Nothing. Elo my, why isn't it like that? Because people don't know, that's all. They are used to seeing the Rav as he's a functionary, he's an employee, and that's his job to sit there. And I come and use the shul as I want. The shul is mine, and I come and I go. It's not so. That's not Rav of the shul, he's the balabos. And just as you go, you don't go into somebody's business without saying hello to the balabos. You don't go into somebody's home to say hello to the balabos. You don't go into somebody's shul to say hello to without saying hello to the balabos. That's in this shul and any other shul, exactly the same. When you say Good Shabbos, you introduce yourself. If you're a stranger, and even if you're not a stranger, where should a person know such a thing from? Where can he know? If he hasn't been taught, if he hasn't been shown, these are simple things. A person leaves the town, he says, he lets people know that he's leaving. He lets his Rav know that he's leaving, he lets his Chaverim know that he's leaving. If he's part of the shir, he lets the Magid Shir know that he's not going to be there. If he's expected at a meeting, he tells them. That people know that if you're expected at a meeting, you send in an apology if you're not going to make it. It's courteous. But you have people who are expected at a shir, they don't send in an apology if they're not going. Why not? Nobody told them. But they should know. Well, why should they know? You're dealing with... Where does it say? Show me. Where does it say in halacha? If you're not going to be at a shir, you must send in an apology. At meetings, it says. Everybody knows. But it doesn't say so. And the Shulchan Aruch doesn't say such a thing. You're dealing with the unquantifiable. Ways to treat people. These are things that one doesn't really easily grasp. Little things that my father commented, do you remember there was a night here where it poured with rain one Friday night? I don't think anybody will forget that evening so easily. So the next morning my father was in shul. So he says, one person came up to him, I don't know who the person was, and says, I live furthest away from the shul. He says to my father. And then he goes into about a 10 or 15 minute description as to how he suffered on the way home. He suffered how hard it was for him. He walked, and the rain, and the hail, and the lightning, and so on. After that, my father saw another person in the shul who he knows lives twice as far as the one who'd just spoken. The one who said he lives furthest away from the shul doesn't live further. He thinks he lives furthest away from the shul, but he doesn't. Somebody else who lives literally twice as far from the shul. And my father went up to him and said, I was thinking of you in the rain last night, I was worried about you. He said, funny, said this person, I was walking in the rain thinking about you, how you were managing. So my father says to me, two people. One comes, he comes himself to tell me how he suffered in the rain. What's to do with me, how he suffered in the rain? Another one comes to tell me how worried he was, how I was suffering in the rain. Two different people. Where does one learn these things? Doesn't learn these things. These one has to learn from... That's the unquantifiable. It doesn't say anywhere in the Shulchan Aruch, when you walk in the rain, think about others. It doesn't say anywhere. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say you must think about yourself either. It doesn't say think about others. It's, by the way, you'll find it more comfortable to walk in the rain thinking about others. It's expedient. Apart from the fact that it's moral,
It's also expedient. If you walk in the rain, next time you have such an experience, if you think about everybody else is suffering, you won't battle that much. You won't even notice it all that much. And that applies to all forms of suffering. If you think about what other people are going through, and you'll find the suffering much easier to handle. But people don't do it. These are things that need to be known. These are things that need to be learned. And so it goes on. That it's all sorts of things. Somebody mentioned to me today, they made a mishabeach for our guest. We had a guest here today. So somebody made a mishabeach. He had an aliyah and he made a mishabeach and mentioned the guest's name. So after his aliyah, after this person's aliyah, the guest went over, walked across the shul, went over to him to say yishukeach, to thank him for the mishabeach. It's a simple thing. It's an obvious thing. But where does it say? Where does it say you must thank somebody for making mishabeach for you? These are things that need to be learned. These are the unquantifiable things. The way to behave, the way to operate. There are countless examples that I come across literally every day, and there's very little that one can do about it except over a slow, long period of educating people. You have people have chasanas, for example. People have chasanas, so there's different kinds of people that they want to have at the chasana. Number one, there are people they're obligated to have at the chasana. So fine, obligated, you send them an invitation. They come, they don't come, they don't come. Then there are people, friends, who you would like to have at the chasna, so you send them an invitation too. And you know they would like to come. Then you have people who you would like to come to the chasna, but they're people then we have people who owe it to you to be at your chasna. Owe it to you. Either you were at their chasna, or you've helped them, or whatever it is, they owe it to you to be there, fine, you send them an invitation. Then you have the sufficient, doesn't owe it to you, you don't owe it to them, you would just like them to be there, so you send them an invitation as well. Then you have people who get a lot of invitations, you get Rabbonim. So it's courteous to send Rabbonim invitations, but now Rabbonim have to make a cheshbon. They get, the average Rav gets 20, 30 invitations to weddings a week. So he's going to start making a cheshbon. What does he do with them? He's 20, 30, so he's got to find a way of being mechalik between them. And also, he's got another cheshbon. Number one, it's just not practical for him to go to them all. Number two, he thinks to himself, it's very nice of this person to have sent me an invitation. They must have felt obligated. Not because they really want me to come, they must have felt obligated. So he's got to try and work out in his mind who really wants him to come and who feels obligated and so on. So what's the way that it used to be done in days gone by? If you felt obligated, you sent an invitation, and the Rav courteously replied that he couldn't come, and that was the end of the story. If it was a situation where you felt you wanted him to come, and you wanted him to treat your invitation differently from the others, you followed that invitation with a personal phone call, or with a visit, or with a personal letter. I'm sending you an invitation, my fiancé and I would very much appreciate your being able to come. Then he knows that this is not just an obligation, this is something a little different, and he knows how to operate it. But people don't know that, people don't understand that. They don't think the process through. Where should they know it from? These are the unquantifiable areas. These are areas which need to be picked up, which need to be learnt. This is the sichoson shel oves. This is the way to talk. This is the way to behave. This is the way to operate. And people don't understand that unless they learn that. And the Torah tells us, Chazal tell us, yofe sichoson shel oves. Look how briefly the quantifiable mitzvahs are stated. That you can work out. All the Torah has to give us is the bare framework and leave it to us to use our mind to work the rest out. But when it comes to the Sichoson Shel Oves, there the Torah spares no words to give you a complete picture of how they operated, how an Avraham Avinu operated, how a Yitzchok, how a Yaakov, even the Avodim, even an Eliezer, how he operated, how he related to Rivka, how he related to her family, how he set the whole thing up. How he sold the project to them over and over again, every detail, so that you should get a complete picture of how that works. So often we've had situations where I've discussed with colleagues or with family members the behavior of a particular bentoro, a particular frum person, and we would talk about, is it right, and isn't it right, and should it be that way, and should it be that way, and very often one would say to the other, you've seen Gedolim, is that how they act? And you think for a moment, you realize, no, it's not. That then becomes the standard. When it comes to the unquantifiable, all you can do is to try and build a model from the great people that one has been exposed to have some kind of idea as to how it operates. My brother said to me once, have you noticed that in the... not only in the Baalei Tshuva communities, but even in the modern religious communities, there's an absence, a certain lack of a sense of humor. Everything is very serious. Everything. Now you would think that's right. After all, this is Torah, this is Yiras Shamayim, these are serious matters. So if you think of it logically, you would think it's actually right. Things are serious. There's no laughing matter in Yiddishkeit. But then he said to me, look, you've seen the Gedolei Yisrael. The ones that you've seen, did they have a sense of humor? You realize immediately, sharp sense of humor, cynical almost. A lovely sense of humor. They knew how to laugh, they knew how to turn even serious situations into something funny. Then one realizes, Sichosom Shalovis, the normality of an operation, how to be normal within that framework, that comes from Sichosom Shalovis, and there are no shortcuts there. In the quantifiable, you can find shortcuts because you're on safe ground. In the unquantifiable, there are no shortcuts. That's an intuitive process of absorption that has to take place over years and years. One has to develop that ability. Our guest today says that we have an interesting shaila in this country and elsewhere about what the definition is of what the halacha calls a miut hamotzui. Miut hamotzui means a frequently found minority. If a certain, take in the case of shchita, in the case of the slaughtering of animals, if certain problems arise many times, find 50-60% of the cases that you slaughter have this problem, then of course you have to be careful. Every time you've got to check. If it never happens, then you don't have to check, you don't have to worry about it. What happens if it happens 30% of the time, if it happens 20% of the time? At what point are you obligated to start taking careful notice of it? The same, you have the situation in the kitchen as well. If in every time you buy a particular fruit, if every time you buy a tomato you find there are worms in it, then you've got problems. If most tomatoes you find you buy have got worms, then clearly you have to check every tomato very clearly before you can use it. If one in a thousand have got a worm in it, you don't have to check for that. If you find the worm, of course, you can't use the tomato, but you don't have to cut everyone open to have a look at. What happens if 5% have got, if 10% have got, 15% have got? At what point do you have to start checking? So the term in halacha is miut hamotzi, a frequently found minority of cases, which is very vague, isn't it? So this the shochet Rabbi Edelstein, who was here today, made an inquiry as to what that amount is. What is a frequently found minority? So he found from one of the leading poskim in Eretz Yisrael two different answers. Both he got from very authoritative sources. The one answer is 10%. 1 in 10 is a miut hamotzi. And the other answer was, there's no percentage. It means frequently found. That's what it means. So he said to me, how do you understand the contradiction? One of them is wrong. Well, what is it? And they're both from very reliable sources. One is in writing, and one is from the son of the poser. So they're both very reliable sources, and they're totally contradictory. And I said to him, I understand it beautifully. The truth is, if it was 1 in 10, then the halacha would have said 1 in 10. That's all. Why does the halacha not give a figure? Because it isn't 1 in 10. Because it means, miut hamotzi, it means you're meant to use your own intuitive field to judge the situation and say, this now needs checking, and before this point it doesn't need checking. But for that you need to have an intuitive field. And this person gave his one answer was to his son, who had the intuitive field, and he gave him the right answer. Miut hamotzi means miut hamotzi, that's what it means. But the other answer that was given in writing, that was given to people who don't have an intuitive feel, and he had to give a figure, so he gave a figure of 1 in 10 as being approximately the figure to operate on. But our need for such measurability in areas which the halacha deliberately leaves undefined is part of all the same malady. Our need to feel secure in things which are absolutely quantifiable. If you can't put the exact quantity, how much? Tell me exactly. How much? How big? How long? I've got to know exactly what it is. Otherwise I don't feel secure. Otherwise I don't feel safe. And we need to know that there are this, there's Sichosom Shalovis, there is that natural intuitive part of Yiddishkeit that we learn through talking to the Gedolei Yisrael, through watching them, to being exposed to them, through building up that intuitive give and take and understanding. And Yofei Sichosom Shalovis, the Torah spends more time and more space on that part, on the unquantifiable part, than on the quantifiable part. And in fact we see when the Goy comes to Hillel and he says he wants to learn one golden rule before he's busy converting, he can't know the whole, how can you learn the whole of Shulchan Aruch in one go? So he wants one golden rule by which he can decide, he can work out whether a thing is right or wrong. It's like Professor Michael Katz told me, he was one of the people that was instrumental in drafting the law for insider trading in South Africa. And various businessmen came to see him to tell him that it was so complex and so complicated, the law that he drafted, that it was impossible for a businessman to operate. If you're going to go and try and learn through that Shulchan Aruch every time you've got to make a decision as whether to buy or sell shares, it's impossible to work that way. So he said to them, you're right. Only a lawyer can really understand it. All you need to ask yourselves is it right or is it wrong? Is what I want to do right or wrong? And the answer you'll come out with is likely to be within the framework of the law. 99% of the time you'll come out right. That's all. What's he saying? In order to draft it constitutionally, I had to make it measurable. To take something as subtle as that and quantify it, of course it's going to be complex and be pages and pages and pages. You can't work with that, so you want a simple rule. The rule is it right or is it wrong? Then ask yourself that question. And so the guy comes to Hillel and says, I can't go through the whole of Shulchan Aruch every time I want to make a decision. I need to know simply, it's some golden rule by which I know whether I can do something or whether I can't. What does Hillel do? He gives him a non-quantifiable rule. Don't do to others what you don't like done to yourself. Exactly, this is, and this might be the makor for it. This posuk in Iyyah. If you want a definition of chokhmah and bina, tzur meira, that's what it is. If you're careful not to do wrong, then you're operating in the area of wisdom, then you're operating in the area of purity. Then you know that there's no material benefit to what you're doing. You're operating only in that area which is pure, in that area which is right. That's the unquantifiable area of Torah, and to realize that in fact the Torah is not divided into two different sections. The section of the quantifiable and the section of the unquantifiable. But that in every action, in every mitzvah, in every halacha, there is a shell which is quantifiable, there is an action, there is a defined deed, and inside that there is a world of the unquantifiable. The feeling, the spirituality, the direction, the beauty, the purity, the sanctity, all that is unquantifiable. And one has to be able to take the two together. One has to be able to take the Maisa HaMitzvah, one has to be able to take the clearly defined Tzivui, the clearly defined instruction, the Halacha as it stands, and one has to be able to infuse into that, that unquantifiable infinity of that aspect of Torah in order to make the thing whole, in order to make the thing perfect. And that really is the part of the purpose of this particular shir. There's a number of shirim in the Beis HaMedrash. There should be a lot more. But there are shirim that deal with different parts of Torah, that emphasize different parts of Torah. They are shirim. Have to be shirim of halacha, where one's dealing with a clear, quantified, measurable thing. What is right and what is wrong and what is the borderline, what is the boundary line. And there are shirim on the workings of that, the logic of Torah, the Gemara, the halacha, the development of halacha. But a shir like this, the Mitzvah Shabbos shir, deals far more with that part of it which is unquantifiable, which that part of it which is not able to be defined exactly. And that's why it's a shir which Baruch Hashem appeals only to intellectually reminded people. There are certain people who listen to a shir such as this and they get very lost. They get lost not because it's difficult to follow. They get lost because it's dealing with undefinable concepts. It's dealing with things that you can't put into a category and actually say, this is it, this is where it starts, this is where it ends, this is its dimensions, this is its definition, and QED put it away and now one understands it. One's dealing with ideas, one's dealing with concepts, one's dealing with thoughts, one's dealing with that aspect of Torah, with the Chochmah, with that aspect of the wisdom of Torah, which deals with the ethical side, with the Sur Meirah, with doing things the right way and not doing things the wrong way. That's the area of Musa, that's the area of Hashkofa, which this Shir deals with, and why the and hence the importance of the shir. The other area to understand in relationship to the shir is that when one's dealing with the unquantifiable, there's no such thing really as now I understand it. When one's dealing with the quantifiable, there comes a point where you can wrap it up. You've gone through it, you can summarize it, you can measure it, you can define it, and you can pack it away. It's now done, you can go on to the next thing. When one's dealing with the unquantifiable, that is never the case. One is dealing with concepts which are living concepts, they're dynamic, and as one grows and as one matures and as one develops, the same concepts themselves take on different forms and express themselves in new ways. It's fluid and it's constantly fluid. And that's why I've often said that this is really not an hour long shir, this is a shir of 10 years. It's a shir that carries on and on, and even when we deal with the same chazal that we've dealt with before, even when we deal with a similar concept that we've dealt with before, there's a new angle, there's a new understanding to it that needs to be incorporated into this whole picture that one develops of the Sichosun, of the Sichosun Shel Ovis. The Shir is based on the views and the approaches and the analyses of the Gedolei Musa, particularly of the school from which we come, And these things are things that grow and develop. There's no such thing as now one has them, now one understands them. It's something that throughout one's life one has to be occupied in developing and in taking further and to giving life to and giving expression to. In Yitz Hashem, I hope that that's the way they've been taken, and that during the recess, which now takes place until the 13th of January, in Yitz Hashem, the Shabbos, the Motzei Shabbos before school starts, that's the 13th of January, will be the next Motzei Shabbos year, that during that time you'll be able to continue not only intellectually working on some of the concepts that we've had, but practically putting them into expression, using them and living by them.